Good afternoon, everyone. Allison Scottberg here, Consolidated Planning Group. We are happy to be here today with North End ISD, as well as Melissa Donovan from the Wewaugh Law Firm. And actually, Melissa, Texas Trust Law Firm, Wewaugh Law Firm, tell me about that, because I think that you guys were known as a law firm for many, many years, and then you guys had a name change. So tell me about that.
We did. So we've been under the name the Wewaugh Law Firm for about 30 years. And recently, in the last year or so, they've changed the ethics guidelines, allowing attorneys in Texas to use what we refer to as trade names, essentially. And as my boss likes to put it, it's easier to pronounce Texas Trust Law than it is to pronounce Wewaugh. So he's gone ahead and changed the name over to Texas Trust Law over the last year or so. So people are still kind of getting used to it. You know, it's a little bit of a transition, sure. But we're getting there.
For sure. For sure. Well, I am happy to be here with both of you today. So I always like to just go over a couple of housekeeping items. So first things first, we are in webinar mode today. So what that means is we can't see you or hear you, but we do know that you're out there, and the chat box is enabled today so that you can put your questions that you have in the chat box. And I'll be going over those questions with Melissa throughout the webinar. We're going from 12 to 1 today. So if you're planning your lunch hour, whatever you've got going on, we will be finished by 1 o'clock. Today's webinar is being recorded, and everyone who has registered for today will get a link to the recording and also a copy of today's slides, so you don't have to write down every single thing that you hear today. You will get a copy of the slides. Consolidated Planning Group, we are a holistic special needs planning firm. We're an advisory and consulting firm. Our whole firm is nuanced in planning for a loved one who has special needs. And so people come to us, they need future care cost estimates. How much do we need to fund the special needs trust are some of the questions. How and when do we pull the trigger on government benefits such as SSI and Medicaid, and then later childhood disability benefits under a parent's record? So we do a lot of advisory and consulting as it relates to that. We help people set up ABLE accounts, have money in the right buckets to preserve their eligibility for state and federally funded programs. I always like to mention this because I think that there tends to be a lot of confusion on what we do per se versus what Melissa does and her law firm does. So we are not attorneys. We do not create legal documents. We do not set up guardianship for folks or create documents for a special needs trust or things like that, which are all things that families that have a loved one with a disability are considerations that are probably on your radar. You've probably heard things about these in the past, and oftentimes they are very, very necessary in the planning process. But what I like to say is Melissa is the legal documents, she's the law, we're the money. So we're the funding. How do we fund our retirement and provide for a loved one that may have care needs 25 to 35 years once we're gone? And so, you know, we're very nuanced in that. She's very nuanced in the legal document side of things. And what I always really like to communicate is that your situation is specialized, and it is really, really important that you do work with a specialist when you're doing your planning. And there are a lot of attorneys out there that can create legal documents, but they may not be specifically nuanced in special needs. They may have limited understanding of state and federally funded programs and preservation of benefits and things like that. So I always say, when it comes to, you know, special needs planning, this is not a DIY project. You do need professionals to help you and guide you and make sure that you've got money in the right buckets and that your documents are definitely set up in the right way. So having said that, today we're going to be talking about guardianship and alternatives to guardianship. And so these are these are topics that are very near and dear to everybody's heart, and there's a lot of emotions that go into, do you need guardianship or some form of alternative? And then also there's a lot of confusion on how this all works. So today, this whole presentation today is to kind of talk to you about how it works in the state of Texas. And I know that we do have people that attend from all across the United States. So I do want to mention today that we are really talking about Texas and Texas law for guardianship. And guardianship is not be all, end all, the same in every single state. State laws are very, very different. So a specific guardianship talk for the state that you're in would be important if you are attending from out of state today. So having said that, Melissa, we're so glad to be back with you today. Tell us a little bit more about your firm and let's get started.
Thank you, Allison. So again, always a pleasure to be back. I appreciate you continuing to ask me back to talk about this because I do agree with you. And I will repeat what Allison had just said, and that it is important that you talk to someone if you are not in Texas, that you're talking to someone licensed in your state, because these rules are incredibly different state to state. And if people move, there's differences there. So you just always want to be making sure that you're talking to someone where you are located. But our firm, we're an estate planning and elder law law firm here in Austin. We do have a presence in several other areas of the state of Texas, but we are mainly located here in Austin. And I, as a certified elder law attorney, which I know makes it sound like I just work with elderly people, but actually what that means is that my specialty in working with individuals is in special needs planning, whether that's with people who have minor children, who have disabilities, and they're dealing with Medicaid, they're dealing with, do I need SSI? They're dealing with the question we're going to be approaching today, which is, what do I do about guardianship? But then also on the other side of things with, okay, well, maybe I'm in that sandwich generation and maybe my kids are okay, or maybe my kids have special needs. And I'm also dealing with an elderly parent who's starting to slip. So I work with all sides of that spectrum. But today we'll touch a little bit on parents, but we are mainly focusing on your children. And as they turn 18, what do you and do you not need to do? As an attorney, we provide legal advice to our clients. Yes, we provide legal documentation. I do need to say today's presentation is really informational, and that's what this long attorney language is on this slide here. So this is meant to be an informational seminar for you to learn some information. Each of you, if you have questions particular to your situation, really should speak to an attorney on your own about your particular situation, because every family situation is very, very different. So when it comes to guardianship, I tend to see people fall into one big, maybe misconception, in that I get a lot of people who will come in and sit down with me, or they give our office a call, and they kind of carte blanche think, I have a child who has a special need, and I've been told I need a guardianship. And not everyone needs guardianship. And more these days, I'm seeing more and more clients who truthfully, they don't need guardianship, and we can go through less restrictive alternatives, which is this big catchphrase I know you may have seen, or you're seeing it right now, or you've heard it, but what does that actually mean? So we are going to go through that a little bit today. If I can have the next slide, please. So when we are looking at this, we call a special needs toolkit, and you know, what do I need when I'm raising a child who does have special needs? And we've got this time frame where sometimes I'm going to have clients come in and sit down with me, and their child might be 4, 5, 10 years old. Sometimes I have clients who are coming in when their child is 17, and sometimes they've already turned 18 and they're in their 20s. And everyone's at a different stage of life. But when you're dealing with a situation where you have children, and maybe you have one particular child, or maybe a couple of your children who you do have a concern about a disability that they might have, the question is, okay, what do I need to do? Allison kind of touched on a few things financially that you want to start thinking about. Like, when do we start thinking about SSI? When do we start thinking about Medicaid? What do we do about retirement? We need to make sure we're taken care of too. That's what Allison and her team are going to be really, really good at, making sure that you can look at the big picture and financially speaking, say, okay, where do we kind of place all these buckets? For our side of things, we're looking at, do you have a proper estate plan for yourself in place? And how does that plan affect your child? As your child is getting closer to 18, then yeah, we're going to start looking at, okay, what are their capabilities? And do we need to go through an actual court proceeding? Because that's what guardianship is. It is a court proceeding that you will have to go through. Or are there other options? So, you know, can my child sign a power of attorney? Do they have at least the ability to understand what that means to let mom and dad continue to make decisions for them? And if we have a power of attorney, what kind of authority does it actually give you as the parent? Because the key here that you always want to be keeping in mind is, as much as we, you know, all kind of have opinions about whether or not 18-year-olds of any sort can make decisions for themselves in the right way, when they are 18, they are technically and legally an adult. And what that means for everyone across the board is that as a parent, of course, you're still their parent, but you no longer have the authority to make those decisions for them. And doctors don't have to talk to you. Schools don't have to talk to you. And in many situations, they're not supposed to talk to you. Now, practically speaking, if you've worked with a, you know, family physician for many, many years, they're going to be graceful is the term I like to use. They're going to continue to talk to you, but technically speaking, the law tells them they're not supposed to. So that's why these things come up. What do I do with my child when they turn 18 and all of a sudden I can't talk to the doctor for them anymore? And there's an issue at school, but I'm not allowed to talk to the school about it because they're a legal adult. What needs to be done at that point in time? So we've got some alternatives here. We've got guardianship. And a big part of this too is also who is around you. So I talked about, like, if you've been working with a family physician for many years, those people are going to tend to work with you a little bit more easily than someone where you're kind of stepping brand new into a situation because they don't know you or your family. So you want to make sure that that team of people around you, whether that's the school counselor, therapists, doctors, all of these people that are part of the team that help you in providing the care that your child needs. Guardianship, in my personal opinion, my legal opinion, and truthfully, actually, the opinion of the judge and the opinion of the court, guardianship really should be a last option. It's not something that we generally want to go to as a carte blanche first choice. This is what we need, because as I previously stated many, many times, it's really not necessary. That's not to say in every case, but as I said before, every child, every family situation is very different.
Melissa, one of the things that we've seen over the last couple of years that has posed a problem is where, you know, a parent really wanted to take a lesser, you know, the least restrictive option with their child, and they had their child sign a power of attorney and supportive decision-making agreement, what have you, healthcare power of attorney. But then later it was rendered by a hospital saying that the person definitely didn't have the capacity to understand what they're signing. So can we talk a little bit more about that and the capacity? Because I think that that is an important factor.
We can. And we do kind of touch on this a few slides back, but we'll kind of jump ahead for a second. So there's a difference between the capacity level that you need when looking at powers of attorney versus a supported decision-making agreement. Now, as a general rule, I will tell you that under the law, capacity is actually presumed in the state of Texas. So the thing is that with different documents, different things that you're doing, you need different levels of capacity. And that can get really convoluted and confusing, but this is what you most kind of base level you want to understand. If your child has the basic ability to understand, I need mom and dad's help on things. So this is a supported decision-making agreement. This is kind of your lowest level of capacity before you get to, we need a guardianship. So the first thing I maybe should say here is that if it is pretty clear that your child does not have capacity and a doctor has made that determination, these are not going to be options. And when it comes to guardianship, before you can get guardianship, you need a doctor to basically attest to that. So if you have a doctor who has said, there's no ability to sign documents, this is not a situation that this child can go through, they don't understand what it means to sign this document, they don't understand that they need help, or someone literally doesn't have the capability of understanding basically anything, then we know we're going to need a guardianship in that case. But if you have, let's say, an 18-year-old who can understand, I maybe don't understand the total technicalities and legalities of signing a contract which is what you would need, technically speaking, to sign a power of attorney. So if you're signing a contract and signing a power of attorney, you need to have a basic understanding of who your family is, an understanding of what you're doing, that you're allowing them to make decisions. But you also have to have a basic understanding of the actual legalities of that document. Like if I'm signing a medical power of attorney, this person has authority to tell the doctor what to do for me. If I'm signing a financial power of attorney, this person has the capacity to call Social Security for me, manage my bank accounts, make changes on my retirement account designations, any number of things that contract technically allots for. So that's kind of your highest level of capacity. And there have certainly been times where I've had clients where we actually do meet that level. Supported decision-making is that in between, where if so long as they understand I need mom and dad or whomever it is that they're naming to be there to help me talk to the doctor, gather information from my school or whomever it is that we need to make this decision about, that supported decision-making agreement, because it doesn't technically allow for the person to make the decision for you, it's just that they can help you, that capacity level is far lower. What I do see, though, however, many times as being a problem with supported decision-making agreements, when the family has not gone through that supported decision-making agreement with an attorney or someone who can really advise them about the legalities of it, what I'm seeing happening more often now is that people are signing supported decision-making agreements. They're not signing the necessary HIPAA authorization that needs to go with it. So I've actually had it happen several times with clients of ours from an estate planning side of things where they've, you know, not reached out to us before their child's turned 18, or someone has reached out to us after the fact. They're not a prior client of ours. And they say, well, we had a supported decision-making agreement. We, you know, did it through this program, or we did it online, or whatever the case may be. But that's all they have. And then when they go to use it, the doctors are saying, well, I can't really share it with you because all I have is this agreement. They still need a HIPAA authorization. So that's the other important thing that you want to keep in mind. But if there is no ability that individual child has to understand those things, then you're going to need to go through a guardianship. Now, the question is, how strict of a guardianship? Are we going full? Are we going limited? And we can kind of get into that a little bit more.
So we've talked about, some of this, you know, the power of attorney and supported decision-making agreement. Someone said, does this agreement have to be finalized prior to the child turning 18? And actually, no, it can't be finalized until after they turn 18. Is that correct?
Right. None of these things can be signed until they turn 18, because until the date that your child turns 18, they're a legal minor, and legal minors don't have capacity by law to sign legal documents. So they have to be 18 before they sign any of these things, whether that's a supported decision-making agreement, a power of attorney, any of those things.
Okay. And we've got a lot of questions in the chat box, but a lot of them, I think that the slides are going to answer. So we'll continue on and then we'll come back to the questions in a few. Okay.
Okay. Sounds like a plan. So when we're looking at guardianship, kind of going back beyond this concern about capacity, you'll notice when we're thinking about guardianship, what do we need to talk about? And that is listed here. It's not the primary thing listed here, though. So the first thing that we want to talk about is, okay, what is your child's actual condition? What is the concern? You know, what are the things that your child is able and unable to do? And then once we know what that is, so maybe it's my child is on the autism spectrum, but maybe my child is relatively high functioning on the autism spectrum, and guardianship may be something that we need to consider for a time being. It may be something we don't need to consider because we can go through one of those lesser restrictive alternatives, or it might be that it is so severe that we do need to consider a more restrictive guardianship. Okay. Now, once we get into knowing what is the condition, what are the things that my child can and cannot do for themselves, you know, as your child's getting into their teens and as they're getting older, are they able to understand when they're sick? What do I need to do when I'm sick? Who do I reach out to? Now, I'm not saying that your child needs to be a doctor themselves, but do they know when they are sick that they need to take medication? Are they able to provide for their regular daily needs relatively independently, or do they need a lot of help with those things? These are all the things that need to come into place and come into the consideration when we're thinking, do we need a guardianship? or kind of where are we on this spectrum between can we sign these other documents or do we need to go to court? Now, as we continue to go through those processes, then we have, okay, well, what are the resources? Are there resources available to help us that we can actually avoid having to go to court, even if just temporarily? And then that goes back to that team of people. You know, it goes back to, you know, the school counselors and therapists and the family you have around you. And can you go to the bank, let's say, for example, and let's say your child has a small bank account. Are you on there? Are you a co-owner on the account? Are you a co-signer on the account? All of these things come into place and you need to think about what can your child actually do and not do. And then, of course, we have this capacity. And going back to what I was saying earlier, the capacity is going to come down essentially to what a doctor says. Then we're going to kind of get into more detail about what that actually means.
I just wanted to mention that because people have kids of all ages, and some people may be on here and they may have a 30-year-old that they don't have guardianship of and maybe they should have. It's not too late is one thing that I want to say. But also you mentioned, you know, like high functioning autism, we see ADHD, we see a lot of families in that middle thing where that they're not quite there yet, but we're still hopeful and optimistic. And it's okay to do a, you know, the least restrictive, you know, alternative and try that for a year or two and see how it's working out. Just because you make that decision initially, the least restrictive, doesn't mean that if it turns out that that didn't work out at all and you do need a guardianship or partial guardianship, you can come back and revisit that. So we've seen a lot of families do that. And I really just wanted to mention that that's totally, totally okay. And really the state would prefer people do that if it's in a situation where it's kind of questionable on whether or not the guardianship is necessary. Is that right?
Absolutely. There is a push where, like I said earlier, guardianship is supposed to be a last resort. So if it's on that line, most judges, and particularly if you are in the larger counties where we have a statutory probate court, in the larger counties, in Harris County, Travis County, and in these counties, you have a special court that those judges only deal with guardianship and estates, probates, things of that nature. So they're really honed in on these things, and they're really going to push against guardianship in most of those areas. Now, if you're in a smaller county where your probates are heard by a county court judge, where they're also hearing family law matters and other things, then you get into some differences in areas. But even across the board, as a general rule, most judges really don't want to have the guardianship in place if it's not absolutely necessary to do it. And if we're going to do it, they want to have it to be as least restrictive as possible, because I always like to say, and it sounds harsh, but truthfully speaking, guardianship is removing the rights of the individual that you are getting guardianship of. And most courts really are not in the desire to take the rights away of someone who doesn't need them taken away from them.
So these rights are like the right to marry, the right to drive, exactly. The right for medical decisions.
It's essentially, and it does depend on what type of guardianship you're talking about, because you've got kind of like you can see here, you have guardianship of the person, you have guardianship of the estate. Guardianship of the estate is essentially the person can't manage their money. You know, they have no ability to manage the bank accounts, pay their bills, do all of those things. So you need to come in and manage money if someone has it. If we're talking about a child, an actual child under the law who is under the age of 18, turning 18, for most of my clients, that's not the biggest concern, because most people, as they're turning, you know, 18 years old, don't have a whole lot of money in their name. And if they truly do have disabilities that we're going to be looking at SSI and Medicaid, they really shouldn't have money in their individual name. So typically we're talking about a guardian of the person. And that is where, if we can go into the next slide, please, we do get into, you know, what are these things that were taken away? And you can see those things here. They don't get to vote. In most cases, they're not going to be able to drive. They don't get to make decisions about where they live, who they marry, weapons and firearms, businessman, all of these things that we just kind of don't think about, kind of take for granted. These are the things that you are taking away from that person, from their ability to do it. And back to one of the points that Allison, you just made a few minutes ago, and this is always something I like to point out here, it is called a permanent guardianship there's nothing really permanent about it. And the reason I say that is even if you have a permanent, so a temporary guardianship is something that's done in an emergency situation. Like someone needs to have some medical situation handled that they don't have a power of attorney that can talk to the doctor for them. And we need something done right away. So we're going to have a quick hearing. We're going to get a guardian appointed. And then that once that situation is taken care of, it's done. Permanent guardianship is someone needs a guardian, like we're normally kind of thinking through, you know, we need someone who's going to be able to, the way I like to put it, continue acting like mom and dad, even after they turn 18 years old. But the reason I say that's never really permanent is you have to go back to the court annually and account to them. And depending upon what kind of guardianship, if it's a guardian of the person, it's a relatively straightforward form that you're going to fill out and send into them. But you do need to attest every year, you know, how are things going? Has the person that has you have the guardianship over gotten better? Has their situation improved? Has it gotten worse? With a lot of my clients who have children with special needs, when we're talking through things and what choices do I make now while my child's young? And I always kind of use the example of, do you want to look at things as half empty or half full? I tend to be a glass half full kind of person. So when it comes to guardianship, when you get that guardianship in place in the first time, maybe you can allow them to retain some rights. The most common things that I do see maintained within the individual is voting. That's one that I've pretty much seen most judges don't have an issue when it's pretty clear that they do have some of an ability to understand things. I actually saw one recently where a judge here in Williamson County had allowed for them to maintain their driver's license, which that's a rare one I've not seen too many times, but it kind of gives you an example. You can see you don't necessarily have to go into a guardianship going, well, I just need to take every single right away from them and I need full control. You need to look at the scenario and the personal situation of your child. But even as time progresses and we go back to the court and we fill out those forms year to year, particularly with children who are more high functioning, there could definitely come a time that maybe you need guardianship at 18, but at 22, your child's in a much better place and they're fine and they no longer need a guardianship. And then when you're doing that annual accounting to the court, you tell them, we're great. This is what Sam's up to. This is where he's living. This is what he's doing. He's getting a job. You don't need a guardianship anymore. And then you can stop the guardianship at that point. Now, in terms of process, these next few slides do go through some of the processes and what's actually required. So in dealing with a guardianship of a person, you are dealing with the physical well-being and placement of the individual. Now, most of your larger courts are going to require some form of a bond. It's not actually a legal requirement under state law that a guardian of the person post bond. So this can vary drastically area to area. So even to the point where earlier, I know we said, if you're in another state, it's really a good idea to talk to someone in your state. Texas being Texas and so large, and there's so many counties and so many different courts, it even is a good idea when you're talking about guardianship that you kind of hone in on working with a professional close to you, because your court might have a difference of opinion on things than, you know, Travis County does. And as silly as some people might say it sounds, there is some truth to the saying that a good lawyer knows the law and a great lawyer knows the judge, even in guardianship, because that person knows what the ins and outs of how that judge likes to do things are. So for example, you know, here in Travis County, we have Judge Herman, who has basically kind of set the bar for all guardianship courts across the state. He requires for all guardians of the person a $13,000 bond. And it's a bond, it's not cash. So it costs about $300 for a permanent $13,000 bond, but that's what he requires. If you go to Williamson County, Judge McMasters requires for most clients a $100 cash bond. And then maybe in Fayette County, they don't require a bond at all. So it just kind of depends on the area, but you do have to meet certain criteria in order to be the guardian. And in this situation, you have to have the ward's best interest in mind. You can't be in contest with the person that you're trying to get guardianship over. And you do have certain duties. And again, I use the term all the time with my own clients. The responsibilities and duties that you have as a guardian are the same essential duties that you have as a parent for your child. You have the obligation to provide for their care and support. and make sure they are protected. Now, what you do not have, because I know I've gotten this question before in these seminars, you are not legally liable for things they do. Okay, so I'm gonna answer that question in advance. So if you have a guardian that you have guardianship over and they do something, I always get the question, like, what if they get in an accident or something like this? If you are negligent in some of your action and that causes it, you could be. But as a general rule, you're not liable for the things that your ward does, but you are responsible for providing for their care and support.
One thing I wanted to ask, you talked about the bond depending on county. I wanted to ask about guardianship and what needs to happen if you move from one county to another county in Texas, because isn't there some requirements that might change by changing counties and moving?
There would be. Yeah. So you can do what's called a transfer of venue. And you do need to do that if the person that you have guardianship over moves. It is not about if you move. It's about if the individual that you have guardianship over is in a different county. So if, for example, let's say you have a guardianship over someone I'm in Central Texas, so I'm going to use the counties around us. So you are in Fayette County, you have a guardianship of the person over your, 20-year-old son, and you didn't have to have a bond in Fayette County. Let's say you then move to Travis County. You do have to do a transfer of guardianship from Fayette County over to Travis County. Now, the process for that is very different than the initial process for actually getting the guardianship, but it is a process that you have to go through the court to do. Basically, the courts need to communicate with one another to get everything from Fayette County over to Travis County. And then back to the example of the bond, Judge Herman would require that you do get that $13,000 bond before he will finally do the order, approve that you are the guardian. So it will differ.
Someone said, can you clarify what you mean by the bond? I think of a bail bond, but is this bond for guardianship, and is it refundable?
So it's non-refundable. It is basically, it's an insurance policy. That's the best way to explain it. So basically you are purchasing a bond from typically from a financial institution, and each county, your judge and your attorneys in those areas would have the contacts about who to go to. It's kind of like people think about a little bit like how people think if you watch TV and you see like, oh, they released him on $30,000 bond and they've got to go get similar, but you're not getting your money back on this one. So it used to be, and I can use Travis County, and I did see someone asked a question about like, are all of the big counties kind of in line with this? And I would say, yeah, pretty much. Most of your larger counties. So I mentioned earlier, Judge Herman here in Travis County is kind of like the main man when it comes to guardianship. Most guardianship courts across the state pretty much fall in line with what he has done, because he has been head of basically the guardianship courts over the state, their main group for years. But it's going to vary slightly. Like maybe Harris County is not 13,000, maybe they have a 12,000 or whatnot. You want to talk to an attorney in your area. But basically you are purchasing an insurance policy. And it used to be that, at least here, it was an annual renewal. So every time you would renew your guardianship, you would also renew your bond, and it was mandated. So back then it was like $150 for the $13,000 bond. And then a few years back, they went to a lifetime bond, which is great because it's $375 is the last that I saw that fee. But it's still a $13,000 bond. But rather than paying $150 a year, now you're paying $375 for the life that you are a guardian. Now, if you are no longer the guardian and that guardianship changes to another person, because let's say you've passed away or can't do it anymore, that next person would then have to go and get another bond. But it's basically like an insurance policy. It's non-refundable.
Okay. Somebody says, who gets the bond money and what do they use it for?
So the bond actually, if let's say you have a cash bond, it's going to the court and they're just holding it. The actual insurance, you're paying the money to the insurance company. The bond is actually to protect the court itself, because the way that the laws work is that you are responsible for your, as I hate the term, we have to use it, it's still the term they use. You are responsible for your ward. The court is responsible for you. So the reason that the courts require these things is it is protection for the court that if you do something wrong and they someone comes back after them, they have some protection in line. That's why with guardians of the person, it's relatively minimal. 13,000 is really minimal. Or like with the smaller courts, you'll see the $100 cash bond, or like I said, in some areas, no bond whatsoever. Just different courts have different processes, different concerns, do things differently. The difference here though, is that's focusing in on guardianship of the person. If you have a guardianship of the estate, you either need to put up your own cash as a bond, or you need to purchase a bond every time. Doesn't matter where you are, but the court is going to tell you how much you need to put up a bond based on the size of the estate if you are the guardian of the estate.
Okay, a couple of things in the chat box. One was, with guardianship, can the 18-year-old attend college? And it depends on the program, and that is a question that you're going to have to specifically ask that university and what programs. There are many, many programs, and we have webinars for this, specifically designed for individuals with disabilities, and those are usually fine, but some others are not. They're not all created equally, so that's something that you'll have to add to your spreadsheet when you're doing the research on that. Another person says, what happens when two divorced parents are at odds over whether guardianship is needed? Who should be the guardian? How do we go about doing that?
So unfortunately, there is no right answer to this question, because if you are divorced and one of you feels that there is going to be a need for a guardianship and the other does not, there's going to be a contested guardianship is essentially what I'm hearing there. Now, if you can work it out between the two of you and come to a determination, that is always best. Procedurally, the way that guardianships work is that when you believe there is a need for a guardian, you have to apply to the court. And if, let's say you are wanting to, so let's say mom wants to be guardian, dad thinks there's not a need for the guardianship. Mom is going to have to put in an application to the court to be appointed that guardian. Now, parents, I want to make sure this is kind of clear. Parents who are married can be appointed as co-guardians. You don't need to be appointed as co-guardians, but you can be. Parents who are divorced are never going to be appointed co-guardians, and they both have a right to be part of that case. So what would probably end up happening if you can't come to an agreement on that is that in this example where mom thinks it's necessary and dad does not, mom's going to go ahead and put in an application for guardianship. Dad may end up contesting it, because when you apply for guardianship, there are certain people that have to be notified, meaning you have to do one of two things. They either need to be served, or you need to get them to sign a waiver that they don't want to be served, essentially saying, I'm already in agreement with this. You got to do what you got to do. So if they're not in agreement, it's going to be a drawn out battle in guardianship court for the one who wants to go ahead and apply.
Okay. We're going to go ahead and go on, and we'll come back to some questions in a bit.
Now, this slide goes through a little bit of the differences and kind of what your necessities are for guardianship of the estate. We've kind of touched on this, so I'm going to skip over to the next slide here. This here goes through a little bit of what we started to touch on, okay? So what is the process? So the first thing that I always like to tell clients when they're asking these questions way in advance, like sometimes I get clients who are super planners, and I love people who are super planners, but I also like to make sure people's fears are kind of brought down a little bit. So guardianship is something that you're not going to actually start to be able to begin the process until about 6 months prior to your child turning 18. So you have two paths to guardianship. You have physician certifications or determinations of intellectual disability reports. So that's going to depend on what kind of a disability your child has that's causing the need for guardianship. So if we have a situation where we have a physician certificate, this is a pretty standardized form that most courts are going to utilize. And you have to have the doctor fill that out. So maybe that's a neurologist, maybe it's the primary care doctor, maybe it's a psychiatrist, whomever it might be. That has to be filled in and completed no more than 4 months prior to the date of the application. So that's a pretty close in time frame. Once that's completed, then we apply for guardianship and we move forward from there. If it's an intellectual disability, you do have a little bit more of a window that you can utilize those reports. So if, let's say your child is about to turn 18 and you had a determination of intellectual disability done a year and a half ago, you're still fine. You can use that report towards doing the application process. So it's just a difference of what we're utilizing. Once you apply and that is submitted to the court is then going to apply and appoint what's called an ad litem. So the attorney that you work with in getting guardianship, what's important to keep in mind is that that attorney represents you. They don't represent your child. That's what the ad litem is there for. So once you apply, the court then appoints an attorney ad litem, and that attorney is who is actually there to represent your child or whomever it is that you're trying to get guardianship over. Number six goes through kind of what I was just saying. There are certain people that have to be notified of the process. So we either are going to have to have service on them, or we're going to have to get a waiver from them. And then it kind of goes from there, depending on court. If we want to kind of go through to the next slide, it continues.
I just have a quick question. I'm back on the divorce and differing opinions of parents. So if it is contested, then I am assuming, and I don't know this, but that the judge would lean towards the guardian ad litem and the document that was completed by the doctor for like prevailing what's best. He's always looking for the what's in the best interest of the child. But 100%. Just because one parent is adamant against it and one parent is for it, it doesn't mean that either parent is getting their way, because ultimately the judge is going to decide there's going to be a guardian ad litem and there's going to have to have a physician certificate signed off on that a doctor thinks that it's necessary. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct. Essentially, what I tell all of my clients is that physician certificate or that intellectual disability report, those are the mainstays of that application. So no matter what mom or dad or sister or brother or whoever's trying to get guardianship thinks, not that it doesn't matter what they think, but their opinion is secondary to what those doctors say. So if we're not meeting that threshold in the opinion of the judge, and then on top of that, if the judge doesn't think the person who's applying to become guardian is truly the best person for the job, they don't have to appoint that person. They don't have to anoint a guardianship. So it all goes back to the judge. And again, kind of all connects back when we're talking about, well, why do we have a bond? All of these things, because the ultimate decision lies within the judge as to whether or not it is necessary, whether or not it is in the best interest of the child or the individual for this person to be the guardian. There are some things here you can kind of see as well. People who would not be able to serve as guardian regardless, you can kind of see here. And I think I saw a question as well in the chat, just kind of out of the side of my eye. Someone had asked about, I think, a physically disabled person acting as guardian for an intellectually disabled individual. That's a total possibility. It's now whether or not it's going to be in the best interest of the individual is a question for the judge, because I could see there could be scenarios where someone with a physical disability would be perfectly fine as a guardian and others where maybe they're not, but that would be a question for the judge. There's nothing that would preclude someone who might be physically incapacitated from acting as a guardian for someone else that is intellectually.
One thing in that question, one key word in that question was an undocumented. So I don't know how that changes things if there's an undocumented person.
So I'm going to say that I have never run across that question, and I would probably err on the side of speaking with an immigration attorney on that as well. Undocumented, there's a lot of variance in that. So I'm not going to answer that question today.
Sure. If we already have a physician certificate completed, but are on the fence, if we really need to proceed with limited guardianship, and she says, say, just do a power of attorney and maybe a healthcare power of attorney, is there a time limit? Like when they can, there's a time limit on the physician certificate. So the certificate over time would have to be redone, but there's not a time limit where they could, you know, they can come back and revisit guardianship later. They would just have to get a new certificate, correct?
Exactly. So the physician certificate, once it's done, you have to apply within 4 months. So 120 days. That application needs to be signed within 120 days of the date on that position certificate. So for that particular certificate, you have a time limit. But that's not to say that you try to utilize, and I've had clients try to do this too, because the issue, which you kind of pointed out earlier, is with financial powers of attorney, medical powers of attorney. Now, financial powers of attorney, if you have a good one, you're generally going to be okay, because with a true statutory durable power of attorney, let's say, you know, Sam is the principal, the individual that has the disability, and Sam has appointed his mom as his statutory power of attorney. If it's a true durable power of attorney without any need for him to be incapacitated to be acting, mom can act right away. And there's not really a limit to her ability to act, short of a bank saying, I don't want to accept this power of attorney for any number of reasons. That's always a possibility. On a medical power of attorney, though, that doesn't give anyone the right to make a decision unless and until Sam can't make the decision for himself. So we will sometimes run into issues on the medical sides of things, which kind of goes back to the supported decision-making agreement, where those do become helpful. And I'm very upfront with people. I am definitely one of those people that when supported decision-making agreements first became available, I was definitely on the side of, I don't understand why these are a thing. I will be completely upfront with that.
I agree.
I was one of those people that I was like, this makes no sense. What is the point of this? I have been converted a bit over time, because in the proper circumstances, they can be really helpful to bridge that gap for someone that doesn't really need a guardianship, but isn't really incapacitated. So the medical power of attorney can't make the decisions. It still allows them to have a conversation and be there to help. So it's just a matter of honestly, putting together a good plan for you and your family, and everything is really personalized, and sitting down with professionals like myself, like Allison, to walk through the spectrum of things that are possible.
I like to tell people that you absolutely don't have to know everything and what you need. When you go and meet with someone like Melissa or another law firm, they're trained to go over that with you, to learn more about your loved one and what they are able to do and not able to do, and kind of walk through those options and what the best options may be and help you get there together. So you don't have to know everything when you go in. I think that it's important to know that. Someone asked earlier, can't a power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney supported decision-making agreement be revoked at any time by the individual? And the answer is yes.
Absolutely.
It absolutely can. A lot of kids at 18 and 19, they don't know that. Some of them do. But they could be angry at you if we have, you know, some of the oppositional stuff and other, you know, behaviors and stuff going on. They could be angry at you and revoke that. That is a possibility. Someone said, and I know we got to move on from a time perspective, you know, on letter G here, a person who by lack of education or experience is incapable of prudently managing the ward's estate. If a parent doesn't read or write, would they be considered lack of education and incapable of handling things for that individual, or is that vary by county and judge?
That is definitely going to be taken into consideration in the judge's determination on whether that person is actually capable of doing the job. Guardian of the estate is a lot more intricate. There's a lot more involved in it, and the court is going to be scrutinizing a lot more than a guardian of the person. So I could definitely see a case where a judge would say, if you are not able to do those things, they're not going to appoint you as a guardian of the estate. They might appoint you as a guardian of the person, but I would err on the side of that's going to be hard to prove to a judge that you're capable of managing all of the financial side of things, if that were the case.
Sure. We got a couple of things I just wanted to re-communicate. No powers of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, or supported decision-making agreement can be signed prior to them turning 18. Can't happen. You already have those rights. You don't need anything signed prior to them 18. You would be signing for them before that. The guardianship process, you can meet with an attorney and start, initiate the process 6 months prior to the child turning 18. So that way it could be in place, you know, real close to when they turn 18, but you can't go and get guardianship when they're 17 years old. And you can also do it anytime later. So after age 18, so maybe you didn't do it, maybe you were kind of testing the waters, you weren't sure, maybe you're getting your money together to fund the guardianship, you can still do it later. So I just wanted to mention that as well.
Okay. Yeah, it's absolutely possible. I've had clients myself where they've, you know, gotten along for years. Like one of the last guardianships I had done, their child was 26 years old. Again, they had the family doctor, they were able to work through things, make it work. But then once they had to change doctors, it becomes an issue. So you don't have to do it on the day of the birthday. In fact, you're not going to have a hearing on the day of the birthday in most areas anyway. But you can do it at any point in time. You just need to kind of play with what's working for you and your family. Now, this does go through, again, those things that we've been talking about kind of right along in terms of those less restrictive alternatives, you know, the powers of attorney, the HIPAA authorizations. A big one I think most people, when it comes to the estate side of things, neglect to think about are convenience signers. So do we have a co-signer on a bank account? Do we have custodial accounts that we can utilize, joint bank accounts? All of these things come into play. Now, one big change that I did want to reference that happened with this year's legislative changes, because I think I actually saw a question on this as well, and in terms of like, what dollar amount counts as an estate? So up until this year, pretty much if you had over $2,000 in assets, you were gonna have to get a guardian of the estate to manage the estate assets. For most of my clients who we are dealing with the younger side of things, we're dealing with someone just turning 18, or like I was saying, someone that's in their early 20s, they don't really have any money in their name. We would always just try to do a guardian of the person, again, because we want to try to avoid as much overwhelming court interaction as we can, where we can. But if you had over that amount, you had to get a guardianship of the estate as well as the guardian of the person to manage it. They just increased that dollar amount with this legislative session to $20,000. So now you don't have to get a guardianship over the estate necessarily to manage relatively modest sums of money. So if you have a guardian, if you are looking for guardianship, let's say over like a young adult, someone in their 20s, maybe they have a little bit of money in savings, and let's say they have $10,000 or $15,000 because maybe they work some part-time jobs or they've been saving money gifted to them by people. If it's not an issue where we're dealing with SSI, we'll just put that out of our minds for a second, because I know Allison is probably having the same thoughts that I would in this. Well, wait, they don't have Medicaid. We'll put that aside for now, okay? But if you're in that scenario, then now what would happen is that when you are getting guardianship of the person, your attorney will assist you in putting through a motion that you can then also be appointed to manage that level of funds. You will still have to get a bond for that money. So kind of like I was saying earlier, if you have a guardian of the estate, there is a necessary bond based on the size of the estate. So the bond that you might need to get, depending on the court, might differ from the bond that you would only have to have as a guardian of the person. And you do have to do the annual financial accounting to the court on that money, but you don't necessarily have to get a full guardianship of the estate now, which is a huge help for a lot of people. We've talked a little bit about supported decision-making agreements. And if we kind of go through into the next slides here, there is a little bit more information on those. I don't know about you, Allison, but for me, this tends to be the thing short of guardianship that I do get the most questions on all the time, because I think it's one of those things that organizations talk about a lot with people. It's kind of like the hot, it's not necessarily new in my world or your world, but it's kind of like the hot new thing that everyone is talking about. So as I said earlier, it is a very helpful tool where it works. In my opinion, where it works well is a very small portion of the cases that I see. But this kind of explains.
And some of it, I know, Melissa, you and I have talked about this before. It's like, wait, I need a document to do what I've been doing my whole life with this kid.
Right.
And for the most part, people will work with you. You've been working with them for a long time, to Melissa's point earlier. But everyone's in the blue moon, they might not. And so that's why I have found that most people that have these have not been that useful. They have them just in case somebody wants to call them on it, but hardly anybody does. And the people that would call you on it probably don't even know what the supported decision-making agreement is, a lot of them. So, yeah. you know, you kind of, you never know with that for sure.
So as I was saying earlier, you know, the nice thing about this is it does have a lower level of capacity that's necessary. It can be a good stopgap, meaning it's something that you can try until you do feel comfortable making a decision that a guardianship is necessary. And the other side of that is you have to show the court that you have thought through these less restrictive alternatives. So if you have done more than thought through those less restrictive alternatives and you have actually tried them, it's just stronger proof to the judge that, yeah, this guardianship is absolutely necessary, because not only did we think about these things and we talked about these things, we tried these things and they did not work. So even in that side of things, it's not the worst thing in the world to give it a shot if it's a possibility. But again, also important to understand, it is very, very different than guardianship and powers of attorney, because it does not give you the right to make the decision. It just gives you the right to help your child make the decision that they want to make. So that's a really big distinction between these two things. Now, in many cases, is it realistically that you're having a conversation with your child and going through these things? And probably most parents in reality are the ones that are prompting their kids. Yes, I probably do believe that. But technically speaking, it does not give you the right to make the decision. So if your child tells the doctor, I want to do X, and you tell the doctor, no, he's doing Y, the doctor is going to do X, not Y, because you don't get to make the call.
Is there, we talked about the guardianship, and the guardianship has to be renewed every year and that kind of stuff. Is there a time frame on how long the power of attorney and healthcare power of attorney are good for, or is it it's stated in the document? I know that those things die when a person dies. I mean, it's done. It's over, right?
Yeah. So as a general rule, they're good forever, unless there's something within your power of attorney that says it's not. So like when we're doing powers of attorney, I could see there might be a situation where we would do a limited power of attorney for a specific purpose where maybe that's different. But as a general rule, your durable powers of attorney, your medical powers of attorney, they're going to be good unless and until you revoke them or you pass away.
One person said, we have a supported decision-making agreement with our son. Do we also need power of attorney? I recommend power of attorney as well as healthcare power of attorney in these situations, but also for anybody who has neurotypical kids that they've sent off to college, I strongly recommend having that power of attorney and healthcare power of attorney for your neurotypical kids too. Be an accident on the way home from college. It could be a mental health crisis. You don't have those things in place, they won't even tell you where they took your kids. I'm a fan of that.
Yeah, we tell all of our clients, you know, and we just kind of refer to it as like a simple estate plan. When your child's going off to college, they're turning 18, simple estate plan. You need basic documents in place so that they have some assistance from you when needed. And to the question about the supported decision-making agreement, when I personally, as an attorney, when I am working with clients and doing them, I am doing them in conjunction with that simple estate plan. I, as an attorney, don't ever really just do a supported decision-making agreement, because I just don't see that as being fully helpful. If for me, I'm going to work with a client, we want to make sure that you're going to have everything taken care of. And if your child can sign the supported decision-making agreement and we feel comfortable with their capability to sign the powers of attorney, we want it all done.
Melissa, I know that we're about to run out of time for today. And everybody, again, I want to just repeat, you guys are going to get a link to the recording and a copy of today's slides. People always like to know kind of a generalized range of what they could think about spending on getting a guardianship and non-contested guardianship in place. If you can just give us a price range that you would think that they would see across the state. And they were asking about that for us. And I think it's important to be able to plan that financially. I also wanted to mention that there are some programs out there. There, you know, Disability Rights Texas. There are different legal aid programs across the state for the indigent that may be able to help with this. I know Galveston County has a grant and they do free guardianship, but you have to live in Galveston County, right? There's a couple of other counties across the state that offer free guardianship, but in general, what could somebody expect to spend on a non-contested guardianship?
So unfortunately, it's a really hard question for us to answer, because there's so much that depends on where you are, the attorney that you're working with, guardian of the person, guardian of the estate. I would say that you should expect, if you're working with an attorney anywhere in the state, you're probably going to be looking, and I'm going to give you a really big range because there's a big range of expenses in different areas of the state, but I would say anywhere between probably around $3,500 to upwards of $20,000 if you get into contested guardianship of the estate. I mean, I've seen some guardians of the estate, not necessarily with children, but with if you're dealing with your parents or people that are older, I mean, you can get into the hundreds of thousands of dollars on those things. So it's hard to give people a carte blanche. You know, this is a good range that you're going to be looking at, because it's going to depend so drastically on where you are, the quality of the attorney that you're working with, and your own personal situation as well.
And I know from a financial perspective, we have a lot of doors that people can go through. We offer a free initial consultation, and we kind of talk about the different tracks, and we take into consideration the planning that you've already done. So it varies widely. I would say, in getting started with us, from $1,000 to say $3,500, it could be upward. But we give firm prices, and it is a broad range. I would say for the most, what we've seen is, I would say $3,500 to $6,000 is pretty standard without, anything being contested and things like that. But it is definitely important to consider that. So so for today, Melissa is available. She's, again, Texas Trust Law Firm, formerly you may have known, we've got the WeWell law firm down at the bottom. Melissa offers consultations as well. Today we were talking in depth about guardianship. She also helps people establish both first party and third party special needs trust. So, these are all considerations. Guys, this is there's a lot of questions today. Certainly reach out to Melissa, reach out to us. We would be happy to answer additional questions that we weren't able to get to today. On the Consolidated Planning Group YouTube channel, there are over 300 webinars on planning for special needs, all kinds of deeper information on special needs trust and kind of how to fund them, SSI, SSDI, college for special needs. They're all out there. So do check that out. You can subscribe for free out there. There is some closed captioning. There may be some options for Spanish and kind of listening in another language as well. So I know that those were some of the things that were in the chat box. When you get the slides today, you're going to get a link for the upcoming webinars, so you can register for future webinars on the various topics. The thing is a lot of this, when it comes to planning for special needs, it's a lot. It's a lot of information. So we do regular webinars designed to give you the tools and resources that you need to be successful to take those next steps. All of those webinars are always free, so you can kind of look at the topics and kind of see where you are on the planning scale. I always like people to meet the team here. We're nationally certified as Social Security advisors, members of the Special Needs Planning Academy, and we do work on a collaborative team here at CPG. If you've got questions that weren't answered today and you want to go deeper, this is a QR code that'll take you to a calendar where you can schedule an initial consultation where we can go deeper with you as well. So I know that we're a little bit over today. Me and Melissa like to talk, and there's so many good questions. Everybody was so generous in putting their questions in the chat box today, and we tried to get to just as many as possible. But we're here to help, and like I said, feel free to reach out, and we'll be happy to chat with you a little bit further. Melissa, thank you for being here with us today, and North End ISD, Kristen, thank you. Thank you for helping us pull this together. Thanks, everyone. I hope everybody has a great week.